bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. It's me and him again. Yeah, it's just the two of us. Forsman must be still moving house because we've not heard a peep out of him for 3 weeks now. Either that or he's realised that this is not the show he needs to be seen on. Carl is still out in his van. Apparently one of the blokes has left his workplace today. He's so pissed off at the extra work. So there we go. It's just me and Alex. But we'll have a swift and erudite show like we normally do. And before we start, there'll be an unboxing. There we go. The non-existent lens from Canon has arrived. Now, I haven't even looked in this, you can see. And this, if this turns out to be a sex toy for my wife or something, I'm going to be in real trouble. But we'll put that there and we'll open that during the course of the show. Mr. Fox, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, actually.
Good stuff.
I got up early and then I thought, I haven't got anything to do. I'm going back to bed. And so the rest of my day has been really good.
Yes. I wanted to go back to bed this morning, but my daughter woke up at 4 o'clock.
That's not fair.
I love her. I really love her. Honestly, is it an unfoxing? Ah, very good chat room. Where's Forsman? Yes. Well, you send him at Forsmax, send him a DM and say, why the bloody hell aren't you on the photo show? Come on, get your ass back. The week in photography news, such as it is, it's not particularly great, it has to be said. One of the key things that we've got, though, is Apple. Apple has done two things. They've got photo sharing in iOS 6. That's going to come. Apple job postings hint at mobile versions of Aperture as well. And also, there's a unified library now for iPhoto 9.3 and Aperture 3. So you don't have to have two duplicate libraries in your computer. You can only have one, which sounds extremely sensible. Should we start with that one, Alex?
Yes, you can.
I mean, the cynic in me just thought straight away, well, the new iPhoto 9.3, all they've done is take the code from Aperture 3 and thought, well, stuff it, give them Aperture 3. Aperture 4's got to be coming soon, so. But they can't do this and then have Aperture 4 not be consistent with the shared library, the unified library. So, I mean, this is a really sensible move, no?
Well, it strikes me it's the only way to go, especially on the grounds that every time Apple bring out a new operating system, the boast is that it's smaller than the last one.
Mm.
But other than people that do video, if you do a scan of your hard drive, the probability is the largest section is going to be photos. So why reduce the size of an operating system if you're going to force people to have two copies of every photo?
Mm.
Especially as they're going over to things like SSD, where the amount of storage is a lot more limited.
Well, I mean, that's a big thing, isn't it? You know, the brand new MacBook that's out this week they've got a revolution towards SSD in the Apple line now.
Yeah.
They've obviously bought up a world's cheap supply of it, so.
Yeah, so it was always really annoying that Apple didn't have just a central space, whether it be iPhoto, Aperture, or just a folder that says photos and is automatically accessible by any photo piece of software that they make. Remembering this isn't a third-party piece of software, this is their software. It always struck me as very, very strange that you literally just didn't have a central, what's the word we like, repository.
Yeah.
You have to be careful the amount of times I've got that one on.
Careful, yes. 10X in the chat room is saying that it's just an index database. You mess with the folder contents and you risk losing the whole thing. iPhoto is notoriously fragile. I mean, it is a package file, but you in the package file, if you open contents, do a right click and show contents of the folder, you actually physically get JPEGs in there. So The database may be corrupt in iPhoto, which means you can't find all of the keywording that you did and all that kind of stuff. But the raw JPEG itself is still present in the folder.
Yeah, I mean, all it needs to do is give it, you give it a name, called it JPEG 001 and whatever you call it. It needs to give it a tag, which can be a 150 long hexadecimal code for all it matters. And you should be able to, you know, link to it that same. That same JPEG could have 500 different codes with 500 different variables and 500 different tags and whatever. There's no reason, as long as the machine can keep track of the original file and link that index code to it, that you can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
The fact that you had to keep so many copies of the same picture. If you run Aperture and iPhoto, which I did just briefly because I had both and I wanted to play with them, and then you go to that find duplicates, I don't know what it came in, some bit of software I was using. Practically every picture I had had two duplicates.
Mm.
And it was, you know, for me, it didn't make any difference because if I was going to throw them away anyway. But for somebody that is actually trying to organize their photo life via those two bits of software, it was ridiculous. The whole thing was completely wrong. And, you know, to make this announcement as if we've done something clever, I think this should be an announcement saying that we fixed something that was stupid.
Well, I think that the thing that you've got to realize is that it is only using a core JPEG and then it's applying EXIF data effectively, I guess, and it's holding that EXIF data in a database. So if the database is corrupt, you lose all the changes that you made, you'll lose any keywording that you've done, any alterations to the EXIF data will disappear and you'll revert to the original data, but the JPEG will be there in the photo library. Super Chicken in the chat room is saying that he uses iPhoto Library Manager, and he says that's very good at rebuilding the database. It works very, very well. But so what I'm saying is for Aperture and iPhoto to utilize the same core set of photos is not a difficult thing. It's not a huge leap, as you're saying there. So it's just the EXIF data and the associated data with the keyframe the database that's the important part.
But strangely, and I don't want to go on to my Apple rant, but for a company that was particularly used by professionals, Apple, iOS, various things have always had some dodgy issues with EXIF data. It's always had there's always some minor little bug in there on everything they've done. You know, you've got the iPhone bug where it doesn't seem to know what way round you've taken the picture.
I mean, that's still on. I wrote to that when I was developer thing. One of my first tickets that I submitted was the fact that it didn't switch the EXIF data correctly.
Yeah, it's a funny thing that it's just one of those things that no matter how hard they try, there's always something else that keeps jumping up and biting them. So, you know, they're going the right way. It tends to be the fact that something new's coming when they fix something old. So let's look in the App Store and see what's available coming soon.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Sasayung have confirmed a UK 8mm 2.8 fisheye lens. It's 10 elements in 8 groups, including an aspherical lens, 2 lenses from the low dispersion glass, plus multi-layered UMC anti-reflective coatings, and it's £279.99. It gives you a view of 180 degrees, and it's a bit cheaper than the Nikon that we saw the other week. But what do you think?
It's the same sort of lens. It does what it wants to do. It probably does it very well. Yeah, I don't know, 10 elements in 8 groups and things like that, you know. I'm not going to bother trying to explain what that means, mainly because I don't know. You've got multi-layered anti-reflective coating, which is very good, especially when, you know, it's 8mm, so you're quite close to things, so reflections are more of an issue.
Yeah, I mean, lens across light across the lens is a bigger factor then as well, and don't forget, because of the fact you're trying to shoot such a wide radius behind you, you've got very short lens hood because it's going to get in the shot otherwise. So you get no protection across lighting.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know how many people have actually tried or used this type of lens. It's a very artistic lens. It's very good for... It's hard to say because it's not... I don't want to get any more abusive emails, but it's not much good for anything other than if you want to take a particular type of shot. The very wide-angle sort of fisheye pictures, they've been around, not as long as photography, but pretty close to as long as photography, and they've got their place. But it seems very strange because there seems to be more and more people going for... or making sure they've got one of these lenses in their armory, as in the manufacturers. But I can't really see anyone other than enthusiasts, if you like, people that want to make that particular image, buying them. I mean, you certainly don't need more than one of these in your camera bag. I mean,
no,
it's not like you're going to get much of a difference. You're going to buy one, and hopefully it will fit on every camera you ever buy because of... You know, if you're talking about various other lenses, zoom lenses and certain prime lenses, yes, it does make sense to have slightly different versions of similar lenses because you will get slightly different performance, but for slightly different subjects. But for something like this, the distortion, if you like, is so amazingly great that, you know, get a good version of this, you only need one. It just strikes me as strange that the amount of manufacturers are coming out with this type of lens, unless it's become cheaper and more easy to manufacture, so everyone's having a go at it.
I mean, the thing with this is it's purpose been built for the Sony NEX range and the Samsung NX compact camera systems, and it's very, very small. And the thing I loved about it is it's got a manual f-stop setting on the top. There's an f-stop ring on it. Instead of being doing it in the instead of doing it in the architecture of the camera, there's a manual f-stop ring, which I love that.
You don't have to reach very far to get to it, do you?
No, exactly. That's it. Right around the front by the focus. I mean, that's a lens from 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that, in a funny way, there's a lot of professionals I know that will like it because it works and looks like a lens from 30 years ago. Is it? You know, like I'd work with photographers. They would never dream of setting anything other than a manual because of, I suppose they work on the theory that this is what I learn. I don't want the camera doing it for me.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes me the same as everyone else.
I spent the whole week this week shooting in manual.
And I bet you're exhausted.
I haven't put it on program or professional or even aperture or shutter priority all week, all manual.
Oh dear. The idea of that exhausts me. I took one shot on manual.
And that was enough.
Yeah, it was it. Yeah. That's all I've done this week. No, not really. But.
Leica are going to open some shops. They're going to open a lot of shops, apparently. They're investing in bricks and mortar. They're going to put up 200 worldwide stores by 2016. They've currently got 37 retail locations across the globe, and in the next 4 years, they're going to put another 200 up. I mean, they're going to start with their first opening, which is Washington, D.C., in the United States.
There's one in Regent Street in London, I'm sure. I'm sure I've been in there.
Does it sell any cameras?
Yeah, it's got stuff in there. It's like I don't want to keep saying Apple, but it's that Apple boutique type of shop idea.
Yeah, I thought Apple as soon as I saw this, yeah.
But they've been around. I mean, they had that Leica shop. I'm going to get this wrong, but I remember seeing that Leica shop probably before Apple built their Regent Street Apple store.
Yeah.
It's been around for a while. The thing is, it makes sense for Leica. I mean, I know sort of the Canon and Nikons and the Pentaxes, and I don't want to go through the whole list and get told off for missing someone out. They're built on more of a mass production selling. I completely can't get my words. But, you know, they sell in mass. They sell to loads of people. They've got loads of ranges. This, to me, makes sense. It's more of a... It's like a boutique. It's a camera boutique that specializes in one type of camera.
I mean, are we going to be talking about, you know, there's going to be one in Abu Dhabi, there's going to be one in Dubai, there's going to be one in Sydney, capital cities of the world, that kind of thing. You're not going to get one in Birmingham. You're not going to get one down the Kilburn High Road or anything like that, are you?
No, but what you will get is wherever you've got high-end clothing stores where people don't mind paying £1,000 for a handbag that they'll never use, to match the shoes that they'll never wear, the husband, when he gets bored of wandering around following his wife, can pop into a Leica store. That's where you're going to get it. You're going to get it in the middle of London. You might get, you know, you'll get one in New York and Washington. That's the idea. There's 200 major places in the world where people with money go to waste it because they're bored, and that's where you buy a Leica.
Well, any of you listening that own a Leica, according to Alex, you've wasted your money, and I wouldn't. I'm not a million miles away from agreeing with him.
Not wasting exactly, but, you know, you've got to have a few bob to buy one.
Chat room says, why? Exactly.
Why?
They're going to be selling replacement bits of glass for all the Panasonic cameras. Maybe that's what it is. It's the mass market they're looking for. Look what the MacBook Air did for Apple. Maybe that's the way forward. I don't know. Maybe so much.
Super thin Leica.
There's a couple of other bits of iOS 6 has got photo sharing involved as well, but photo sharing on PhotoStream is something that I could see getting some people in an awful lot of trouble if they don't remember to switch it off. The last thing you want is your picture that you've just taken on your iPhone appearing on your Apple TV while your wife's watching it.
Well, what would be good, though, is if you I don't know how photo sharing is going to work exactly, but if you could link, you know, like you can share a Dropbox sharing thing. Now, if you can link six people to a library and you're all going on the same trip or you're all at the same party and it automatically updates all of your pictures that all of you have taken at that party into one place, so it automatically shares for everyone at that space, that would make sense to me. Mm-hmm. You know, a community picture of, I don't know, the football match. Everyone can link into the community of that football match and everyone's pictures will turn up in the same place. That works.
That would be useful. But I don't think it's going to do that.
Probably.
Never mind. Let's do our six things. That's all the news there is. It's really poor, actually, I have to be said.
And that was pulling it to bits to try and get something out.
Those were the best ones of it. Let's do the unboxing next, actually. That'd be even better. So, apparently last week there was a non-existent lens. And the non-existent lens was a new 40mm Canon pancake lens that was supposed to be extremely good, extremely silent, and perfect for video. And thank God it actually is the correct lens. Here we go. That's it.
Just a question. What have you been shooting all week?
People. Interviews.
Have you been doing any video?
All video.
So that lens would have been quite useful if it had arrived.
It would have been quite useful if it had arrived a week ago. Thank you. Well, here it is. Now then.
Oh, I thought that was it. I thought that really thin piece of paper was the lens.
It's not a million miles away, no. But
it's an adapter ring. That's not a lens.
It's actually interesting. You look there, the bayonet is actually quite large in comparison to the rest of the lens.
It's got to hold on with something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I brought a camera with me just to test whether it actually is silent and whether it even works. But there we go. There you go. That's on my 1DS Mark II. So just to give you an idea of how small and short that is, that really is quite weeny.
It's very small.
Just make sure it's on automatic. Here we go.
The only trouble is you need to turn off the beep every time it gets the autofocus.
It's not silent.
Makes for great audio, that does.
It's not, well, you can hear it beeping, but it's not silent. It's definitely, but it's pretty fast though. I like that.
It hasn't got anywhere to move to. It's only got about a millionth of a millimetre.
Yeah, but it does go bzzzt. It's not as bad as this one. I mean, this thing's like when it moves, but that wasn't bad. That was okay. I like that.
For £1,000, it's not bad.
It's 200 quid. 229 quid. Bugger off. There we go.
Not what I'm telling the missus.
Unboxing done. Six things. What six things? They've come by Stephen McConvery this week. Thank you, Stephen. Which six tools, tips, or tricks would you suggest for motorsport? Mr. Fox, you want to start us off?
Well, there's
two that I'm hoping you aren't going to take, which you are.
Right. Well, I won't mention the length of the lens or the speed of it then.
Okay. Chat room's already done squeaky toy, but dumptish. Thank you.
Yeah, what you want to do is throw the squeaky toy in the middle of the motorbike race and see them all try and skid past and not come off at 180 mile an hour. Right, let's try and pick one that he won't think of. How about picking somewhere where, like a corner or something, where the vehicles slow down a bit and pre-focusing your lens. To stick it on manual, pick a point and pre-focus your lens so that when they are bent, they're coming around a bend, so they've slowed down a tiny bit, you can get an interesting angle, because you're never going to get an autofocus fast enough if the cars are anywhere near you. The pre-focus to a point and fire away merrily once they get to the bend facing you. I'm not going to do the obvious one. I'll leave that for you. The pre-focus is a good one.
My pick was going to be a fast lens. Make sure you get a fast lens. No question. You want something that's going to shoot pretty quickly. You want a camera that's going to shoot probably up to, if you want to catch things still, maybe 1/2000th of a second or higher. Your cheap little compact isn't going to do it. And And yeah, well, there's 10X in the chat room has lightened the situation ever so slightly by saying, yeah, photographer was killed in a recent road bike accident. Just saying. Thanks, mate. Don't do it, I think, is 10X's, is 10X's advice.
Another thing is, if you want to adjust anything, set the speed first. So set it to 500 or 1,000 or whatever you want to set. Mm. If it's not, if the exposure's not right, then play with the ISO and things like that. Don't play with the speed. The speed is that's the one variable you want to lock down.
10X's point apparently was long lens. Don't use a 40mm pancake lens for a close-up at 200 miles an hour. No, I was going to say something else then, but I've forgotten it now. There we go.
Okay. How about panning techniques? They're very useful.
Oh, mate, focus while panning. Practice. You shoot all day and get nothing, maybe.
Well, maybe that's a good point for having the focus pre-locked, if you like, on a manual focus, and then just practice panning around and doing a burst mode while you're panning. But one of the things, remember, I mean, this will upset Chris if he ever comes back, the bugger. One of the things is, don't try and zoom in too hard. If you've got a 20, 25 megapixel camera, make the picture make it slightly wider so you've got more chance. If you do miss the car slightly when you're zoomed right into it, you're going to cut the end of the car off. So don't try and zoom too close to whatever you're trying to photograph or the motorbike. Leave space around it, because if you've got 25 megapixels, crop it to then make it look centered or whatever you want to do, and you'll get the whole vehicle in. Don't try and be too clever, in other words.
I'd pray for good light as well, because one of the things that you're going to be able to do then is push your f-stop setting up. So if you're sort of 100 feet away and you want to get a decent image, then f4.5, f5.6 is probably going to give you a big enough depth of field that as the camera's passing through your fixed point that Alex has suggested, you'll get a lot of it in pretty good focus. If you start shooting in 2.8s, even at 100 feet, you're going to get some stuff in, some stuff out, and you're probably going to get none of them where the driver's in focus at any point or the headlamps are in focus at any point, and it'll go through a bigger f-stop setting.
But this is the perfect thing for digital, isn't it? Make sure you shoot on a burst mode. Don't try and be too clever and just take a single shot. If you've got a vehicle going past you, do a 10-shot burst mode I know it's spray and pray, but when you're doing something like that, if you get one of those 10 being the perfect shot, you'll be really, really happy. But if you do two or three, the chances are very limited that you're going to get the shot you want.
Paul in the chat room is suggesting cropping is your friend, but I've got to say, Paul, that's fixing it in post. Tut, tut, tut.
Well, what I'd say is don't try and zoom in too tight. You know, crop the image afterwards. Because you do try and shoot it that you've got, you know, the nose of the car and the boot of the car or trunk, whatever they call it, at the other side, you're not going to get it. I don't care how good you are. They can miss it with a TV camera, they can miss it with a point and shoot.
Still fixing it in post, dude. Not having it.
Don't have it then.
All right.
You can have your pictures where the front of the car's missing, and I'll have mine looking nice.
Questions. Question one. Hi, guys. It's from Roger Beatty in San Diego. Thank you, Roger. Keep them coming in. I'm not a great photographer, but still love listening to the podcast. I'm picking up the odd tip here and there. I've got a question about putting my pictures on canvas. I own a compact Panasonic Lumix, which has 12 megapixels. While we were out on a family trip the other day, I got a nice landscape in the forest we were walking through, and I'd like to hang it on our wall in the family room. I figure that I'll need it to be a pretty large size, maybe 38 by 48 inches. Will a 12 megapixel image manage that size, or is there something I need to do to improve the image first? Well, your first tip is going to be you can't improve it. Wherever you've shot, you've shot. So the size is as the size does.
Right. But
you might, you could do saturation, et cetera, fair enough, but you're not going to get it. You're not going to get detail that's not already there. Sorry, Alex, your turn.
You're right. But I think the improvement meant, am I going to need to boost the size or anything? Mm. If you'd send it or take it to a proper printer, 12 megapixels, I've seen some really astounding shots off of the D200, which I think was 10 megapixels, and I've seen, what's 30 by 48? I can't think what that is in English. So that's nearly 3x4, yeah? Feet.
Yeah.
Is that right?
It'll do.
I've seen bigger than that off a D200, and I've got to admit, I was amazed. The thing is, we assume, first of all, you're talking about canvas. No, you don't have to print a canvas at 300 dots per inch. But 200 is more than enough on a canvas. 150 is probably
good. You'd probably find that a 12 megapixel image at 72 dots per inch in black and white would get away with it, because you'd want that grain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, yes, you could definitely get a professional to print a 3048 on canvas. I use something called Genuine Fractals, which makes unbelievable claims about enlargement. But, I mean, any professional lab will have something similar. I mean, it's not like the bicubic enlargement that you get in Photoshop. If I wanted to enlarge a picture in Genuine Fractals, even with my quite modern Mac, it still takes 30 seconds to process the image.
I've got to say, up to sort of 400 to 500%, I've not seen a real difference between the built-in bicubic interpolation in Photoshop and Fractals.
Oh, right, okay. But what the
you're not going to see a huge difference.
Yeah, but minor. If you want to do this, go to pay a little bit more and get it done by hand. You know, get it done by somebody that does that for a living, and you'll be really, really surprised about the quality of the image. But the answer is definitely, on a canvas, you don't need to print as much as a DPI as you do on a piece of flat paper anyway. So, yeah, you can get away with murder with a canvas.
I mean, my advice, like I said, you can't get detail that isn't there anyway, so I wouldn't worry about it. And if you upload the 12 megapixel image, you'll probably find it'll come back with very, very reasonable results. If it doesn't, if you think it's going to be a problem, you can always go with a coarser grain on the canvas, and the coarser grain on the canvas will offset any errors that there are with your images. The one thing you would look for, though, is just watch out for any red dots, you know, blue dots, that kind of stuff, where the image has looked at low light areas and the camera's guessed at what the color is there. Try and get rid of those before you send that up. Otherwise, when they come back on a big canvas, they're going to be huge in comparison.
Yeah, the only thing is with a canvas, though, just make sure the blacks are slightly back, not necessarily the contrast, but just make sure the blacks. Do that in levels if you want, but make sure the blacks are quite black, and then you really won't have any problems. Because if it is blue or red dots, it will darken them enough for them not to show up.
Mm. Question two from Gary Bond in Swindon. Afternoon, gents. I noticed the other week on the show that you mentioned the Canon 50mm 1.8 lens, and that certainly Ewan said he uses it for a lot of images that he takes. There you go. That's what it is. One of those. I know that there is a version at a similar... Oh, hang on. No, I've missed a bit there. He takes. I went to look on the internet to buy it and found out it was only £80, which surprised me. I don't mean to be rude, but why would a professional use such a budget lens so much? I know that there is a version at a similar price from Nikon, and that Alex has mentioned how good it is in the past. What does this lens give you that other more expensive lenses don't?
Money in your wallet. I think the question should have been, no. What does a more expensive lens give you that this one doesn't?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Fair point. I mean, I don't know. The question, I guess, is why would someone like you and me rely on something like this so heavily?
Because the difference that it makes when you buy a very expensive... Don't get me wrong, I've got expensive lenses, but, you know, some of us don't like to brag about our expensive equipment because, of, you know, might get robbed. But... there's a lot of equipment which is middle of the road, if you like. I mean, £80 for... I mean, it's a good price, £80 for that lens, don't get me wrong. But as long as it stops down to where you want it to stop down to, or it opens up to where you want it to open up to, and it's a good enough quality glass, myself and Ewan, what we use these lenses for, it's not... We're not trying to zoom into something that's like an amazing piece of jewellery that the tiniest diffraction of light or something is going to show. What we're trying to do is if you like, it's the workhorse lens. You know that you're going to get a good, sharp image out of it. You know that if you stick it on a certain aperture, that's the aperture you're going to get. You know it's not got too many variations. And let's face it, if you're going to use a lens every day and it's good enough, buy one that costs you £80, because if it is going to crap out, I think is Ewan's favourite word, you can go and get another one. If you spend £500 on every lens you've got, it's not going to last any longer than your 80 pound lens. But you're going to have to go and spend £500 whenever it craps out, or £500 whenever you forget it, or whatever you're going to do. If a lens is good enough for all you want to do, don't necessarily just go and spend a fortune because there's one that makes slightly better claim. Because I tell you, for 95% of the shots you're going to do, having the £500 lens is not going to be improve the shot in any way whatsoever.
No, agreed. I mean, the one thing that I spend a lot of time is industrial sites. So something like this, it's small for a start, which means it's not going to get a clout in dead easy. And the other thing is, at £80, it's semi-disposable, I guess. I mean, I've had this one for 8 years, and I've never changed it. But if I dropped it and broke it, this thing's paid for itself 100 times over. Maybe more. So it would be dead easy to go and replace it. I mean, I look after it. It's got a UV filter on it to make sure that I don't scratch the lens. So it's a great lens. I mean, the thing is as well is that at 50 millimeters, I don't have to get too far away from things to get them in. There's no barreling on the lens, which means that I don't have to correct for too much distortion afterwards. And I've got flexibility because I've got the depth of field from 1.8 right the way up to 22. So in terms of versatility, if I turn up at a job not knowing what I'm going to do or what I'm going to shoot, this thing's perfect for that. And the other thing as well is that it's good for shooting video because it's prime lens. So
yeah. And the other thing I'd mentioned, not necessarily about that lens, but shorter lenses, quite often I'm photographing, I don't know, something in some royal society or something, some little knick-knack, some ring or some scientific instrument that nobody knows what the right angle is. Nobody knows what the best picture is. So I'll take 10 shots. And there's nothing worse than it being a tiny bit out of your reach every time you need to take another exposure or take a different angle. So if you're close enough to something where you can be moving it at the same time as you're looking through the camera, it will save you hours and hours and hours of work. As, you know, when people are shooting things for eBay, imagine you're shooting something, say you're trying to sell your iPhone, I don't know, your iPhone size thing. It's a lot better if you can take 5 shots and be able to move it to get the perfect picture you want and still be looking through the camera at the same time than moving it, going back to the camera, realizing it's wrong, moving it back, realizing it's wrong. So quite often these shorter lenses are invaluable to save time, if nothing else.
Mm. Yeah, good stuff. Chat room says, I like that. I've got one of those. Brilliant. Russ has got the lens. Very nice. Very popular too. Teresa says, I've got the Nikon lens of that. I didn't realise Teresa shot Nikon.
Well, you know, she's a classic. She's a classic girl.
No, but I used to fancy her, but not now. No. I've got a film camera with an automated setting for manual focus lenses. Whenever thinking comes into focus, the shutter's released, says Super Chicken. Well done. Teresa's got taste. And Russ says, WTF, I know Gary Bond, he lives in Swindon. Well, maybe you do. There we go. Question 3 is from Mark Denham in San Francisco. Dear Carl, Alex, Chris and Ewan, got half that right. Thanks for the podcast. I'm a huge fan of all the shows on the network. Keep it up. My question is about correcting an image that is out of focus. I shot a picture of my kids in the backyard a couple of weeks ago and wanted it to look really cool, so used a narrow depth of field. Unfortunately, the kids' noses are in focus and their eyes aren't. Is there anything I can do to help correct it? It's a pretty nice picture of them, Mark.
Do you want to destroy his hopes or shall I?
Oh, it depends how much, though. I mean, sharpening will help you. Sharpening will pull stuff back that's less recoverable, but if you've got unrecoverable out of focus, you Alex is right, you're stuffed.
Selective sharpening.
I was going to say spot sharpening. Yeah, go for it.
So selective sharpening. One of the things you can't, I'd say, I don't know what software you're using. If you've got a professional piece of equipment, and I don't know, you might be able to do this on other equipment. If you sharpen, the easiest way to do it is sharpen the whole image. So maybe you get the eyes a bit sharper and maybe the mouth a bit sharper. Just sharpen that. And the easiest way to do it is then use the history brush tool and paint out the bits that were originally in focus, like the nose or maybe the top of the hair or something. And then you'll get an overall sharpening, but not over sharpen the bits that were already there. Or alternatively, the best trick to use is make a slight, use the out of focusness. So possibly sharpen the eyes, sharpen the teeth, sharpen the top of the hair or something, and let the other bits blur a bit. Or, again, you can blur the whole image a tiny, tiny bit, a tiny bit of Gaussian blur, and then use the history brush to take out the eyes, take out the hair, take out the mouth, so, and then resharpen them. So it looks like you've done, you know, in the old days, they used to shoot through a pair of tights or something, and it used to give you a slightly blurry effect. So it will then become an artistic shot with the pieces you want to be sharp looking sharp. What makes things look worse out of focus is if you've got something that's in focus in the same picture. So if the whole thing's slightly out and you sharpen the, say, the bits that matter, like the eyes and the teeth, maybe at the mouth and the top of the hair, it looks artistic. It looks like you're supposed to do it, and that can recover a picture in an artistic way. But that's possibly the best you're going to get out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, the ways to skin the cat are pretty innumerable there, but I would suggest that you could also create a selection around the key areas that are that you want sharpened, and then heavily feather those, and then run a sharpening brush over them while they're selected. That'll do the same thing as Alex is talking about. Other thing is duplicate the layer and sharpen the top layer, and then just slowly rub stuff out with a very, very soft eraser tool, and go over the whole image till you're left with just the items that look like they're sharpened. There's tons of ways of doing that thing, exactly the same process. But
if you really are stuffed, then there's things like, there's certain filters, like, I'm trying to think what they are, high-pass filter and things like that. So it actually turns it into an artistic creation rather than a photograph, and then the sharpness isn't so much of an issue. You'll see things like Andy Warhol prints in the old days. They were, you know, I don't know if he did them on photographs and then transferred them, but they're artistic versions of a photographic image, if they're painted or not, I'm not sure. So, you know, you can turn something that you think's unrecoverable into a really wonderful work of art, which will mean exactly the same to you in years to come. It would just be an artistic creation rather than a point-and-shoot photograph. So never throw anything away, because it is always recoverable in some way.
Maybe not as you first thought. Content aware sharpen, you can hear it coming already. Photoshop 7.
Well, there were. There is techniques, and they were originally devised. I spoke to someone in the military years and years ago, and there were techniques for recovering out of focus shots, because what they did, they used the computer to analyze things into layers. And they did selective sharpening, and there wasn't only sharpening, they could actually refocus images. So I've got a feeling there was something that Adobe was showing as a possible for the new, I mean, it hasn't come out, but they were showing a refocusing tool a year ago, weren't they?
Probably, yeah.
There was some show, and they were going, oh, it's artificially unfocused, so it would be put back, but... Don't get rid of it, because it is coming, because I have seen a demonstration of something. So, you know, in years to come, they will be able to refocus that for you. But there is a few techniques you can do now while you wait.
Chat room's turned into eHarmony. British Mac Fanny's trying to flirt with Teresa by saying, I have a beautiful Nikon AF-S50/1.4G. And I love the results. Teresa's come back with, she's got the less expensive 1.8, to which British Mac has then gone for the killer blow, which is, where's he gone? Stop typing in the chat room. It keeps pushing the things up. Teresa, do you prefer to use the zoom lens most of the time rather than your prime? Teresa is in her prime, mate. Teresa's come back with a point that makes a point about her husband, though. So there you go. Sorry, Steve, you're done. It's all over. Last question. Hi, Ewan. I've been listening to the podcast for a while now, the Photo Big and Mac. Over the last couple of weeks, I've been lurking around in the chat room on Speedbird when allowed, and have time away from work, which in itself causes its own problems. Have the group ever covered camera gear insurance? I'm getting to the stage now where my camera gear is a similar value to a small African country, and I haven't got any insurance. Why? Because they all promise the earth and they never deliver it. When I fall over and land on my new Nikon F28 70-10, will they pay out? When it falls off my neck into the river when photographing a waterfall, will they pay out? There always seems to be a get-out clause for these merchants. What is the view of the group, and do you recommend anyone? If only the British Tech Network did camera insurance. No, we don't.
Yes, it's like an advert. If we did camera insurance, it would be the best camera insurance in the world. Yeah, I mean, I have... you know what? I can't remember what the company...
It'd be useless after a couple of beers, though.
We'll be able to focus on anything. I use a specific camera insurance policy. A lot of the companies you talk about, like home insurance, and funny enough, my home insurance does cover my cameras, but it's just a fallback. I doubt they'd ever pay out. I just use camera insurance companies, and I think I pay £400 a year. But £400 a year covers slightly more than a couple of lenses and a few bits and pieces. It covers me. It basically covers me for everything, plus any damage I do as a photographer. It covers me, my public liability insurance. It's all sort of grouped together, but that does cost me, you know, more than most people would be willing to pay for insurance. But if you really do want to be insured, then you need to insure on a separate policy purely for your photographic equipment. £400, you know, you probably get a £100 a year insurance. But remembering it's not just what you lose or you break. It's sometimes when you're taking photographs and you're standing on a ladder and you're hanging over the top of something to try and take a picture, if you drop your camera or you fall off or you drop your camera on someone's head or you do some damage, that's worth being insured for. So if you're that bothered, don't rely on your household. You can add things to your household insurance, but you'll end up paying more probably than you would if you ended up just doing a camera-related insurance policy. And as for the company, I can't remember who I'm with at the moment because I changed about a year ago and I can't remember their name, but I'd look it up.
I think there's a difference for the two of us compared to other people, though, Alex, in that our equipment pays for itself, whereas theirs doesn't. If you look at an amateur, the amateur's equipment never pays for itself. So they will talk about accidental loss or damage to the unit. So they drop it into a waterfall, they fall over and land on it. I wouldn't claim for that anyway. And I'm not sure my insurance actually covers me for accidental damage. Mine, I've got Barclays Business Insurance, and I'm specified as a photographer, and I'm specified that if there's theft of my equipment while I'm out working, providing it's not left unattended, they'll cover it. So if I've locked it in a boot and it's stolen, I've locked it in a room and it's stolen, if it's in a customer's premises and it's stolen, the customer's premises have got to start talking to my insurers to see who's going to pay me, but I am going to get paid. But accidental damage, I don't think I'm covered for that particularly. I'm certainly covered for professional indemnity, so if I cock up a set of wedding photos, it'll pay for the reshoots and that kind of things. But I think the key is that you and I, Alex, are looking for different things from the insurance because our equipment pays for itself. This camera has paid for itself tenfold.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and like I said, this lens, if this lens broke, I see this as disposable. I don't, you know, I should probably have three of these just in case.
But so what I would definitely warn about is, I mean, I had a friend around here the other day asking me for details of camera repair places, specialist ones. His home insurance, which has got cameras, it's got this, it's got that in there, even, you know, named items, he dropped it, he banged it, and they refused to pay for it, even though. And the only thing, oh, they said, no, that's not accidental, that's negligence, or I can't remember what it was. But, you know, he said, he'll fight them, he'll do this, he'll do that. But, you know, you get what you pay for. He now wishes he never bothered adding that to his insurance policy. So I would say that you need to ask specific questions. Am I covered if I'm stupid enough? Well, stupid enough is wrong word. Am I covered if I drop the lens? Am I covered if my kids spill orange juice in my camera? You need to ask specific questions. And, you know, quite frankly, you will be paying for it, but all the things that sound like they're a bonus, I've never known anyone actually get paid out for them. So just, you know, you get what you pay for. That's basically what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. But look at the small print before you sign. But I would start looking at some of your equipment being semi-disposable. It's a consumable. Some stuff is consumable items. Chat room agrees with me. Very true. Difference between pros and amateurs. I wouldn't insure my stuff because it'll cost me more than buying another one if I lost it. Why doesn't Mike create create a special bank account and put away the insurance premium he would pay and use it to buy new lenses when he breaks the old ones? That's an even better idea. Save. That goes back to the 1950s. Saving for the future. Blimey.
Very, very sensible.
Very sensible.
Is that Teresa again?
That's very sensible. That was Teresa. She's sensible. Yeah.
She's just taken over the world, that lady.
She's a good catch. No, you're not born in the 1950s, Teresa. No, sorry. That's not what I meant. Not what I meant at all. British Mac fan still trying with his hardest chat up lines, but for portraits, I like the prime lens.
Well, if you really want to chat them up, try that 40mm.
If you want to chat up Teresa, then all you've got to do is come to the British Tech Bash. It's 6th of July. It's now less than a month away. 3 weeks from now, we'll all be sitting getting rained on heavily, making podcasts. But we'll have drunk sufficient beer for it not to matter at all. So go and get yourself a ticket. Get yourself over to britishtechbash.eventbrite.co.uk. It's 20 quid for a ticket. And when you get here, there's going to be free beer, free food, lots of fun, loads of podcasts. Andy and Atco, me, Alex, Carl, Steve Neighbour from the London Mac User Group, a few people from the London Mac User Group are going to be here. Aaron's going to be here. There's going to be a whole pile of us. And we're going to have a great fun, and we're going to have a little band going that's going to be us playing, and we're going to have us doing karaoke, and we're going to have us doing the podcasts, and it's going to be good fun. TechSmith are sponsoring the event. They're going to be providing piles of food and beer. So you need to say thank you to Betsy, who's also going to be here from TechSmith. So there you go. They're the people that make Camtasia and Snagit. Book your ticket now. britishtechbash.eventbrite.co.uk and you can chat up Teresa. Promise. The people that we are very grateful to is UK2.net. They host the podcasts for us on their servers, on our servers. And they've been with us 3 years now. Absolutely brilliant. If you'd like to support us, you need to support them. So if you've got a UK2 account, use the click through on our website and they'll know that you're a returning customer who used British Tech Network. They'll thank us for that, just the fact that you use that click through. If you want to buy anything, this is where it gets really good. Fill your basket up with whatever you want to get from them. Anything that's web-based, domain-based, that kind of thing. You can get anything you like. And then start putting in the offer codes. Key is, don't put in your payment details before you've done the offer codes. Do the offer codes first. So if you've bought domains and you've got a whole pile of things in your basket, type in British Tech Domains. Don't forget the S. It's domains, not domain. And hit return on your computer. That will update your basket. But it will then say that's an error because there's no payment details in there. That's fine. It doesn't make any difference. Next one you put in, say you've bought DNS management that comes with your domain transfer in, that's £20. If you type in British Tech DNS and hit return, that charge will disappear entirely for 2 years. So you get that for free. Brilliant. 20% off your domain, free on DNS. Type in VPS and do the same thing, and you're going to get your first month's VPS free, I think. VPN, you're going to get that. First month, 50% off, I think, or I've got those the wrong way around, maybe. But British Tech and then domains, DNS, VPS, VPN, all that kind of stuff, and your basket will slowly decrease in price. You could technically end up with a zero balance basket, which is brilliant. Then when you've done that, then put in your payment details and then pay UK2. They're fabulous. They've really looked after us. They've got a long-term commitment to us, and it's going to carry on as well. They're not looking to pull away from us. You guys give them lots and lots of business, and they're very, very grateful. Please support them, because inadvertently support us. Thanks very much, UK2.net, for your sponsorship. It's very special. Right, mate. Where can we get a hold of you?
Where can you get a hold of me? Try Alex G. Fox on Twitter.
Excellent, mate. Thank you for joining us. Hopefully there'll be just more than us two next week, so, but I doubt it.
We can carry it off.
We're doing this. We're doing fine. Erudite quick podcasting. Two people, 30 minutes, job done. 4 questions today as well. I'm Ewan Rankin. You can get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter, or you can get the network on at British Tech News at British Tech News. And if you've got a photo question, send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll add it in the show, and your question's going to get answered. Anything you like. We know the answer, we'll tell you. If we don't, we won't.
We'll still tell you.
Have a great week. Max Show's coming up next. We've got Andy and Atco on, and it's going to be really, really fun. See you in 30 minutes. Thanks for listening.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.